Good morning. Thank you, worship team. I'm Linnea McDonald. I'm the youth pastor here at Arbor Heights. And getting started this morning, I have a question. Do we have any superhero fans out here? Who likes Marvel? That's not very encouraging. You're supposed to be supportive. Thank you. Sorry, that's my fiance. I'm like, so that's why I'm talking to him like that. I'm going to be honest. I have not always been the biggest superhero fan. I'm kind of picky. My favorite's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I like pizza and being goofy. But throughout my life, I have somehow, despite also not being like big on Marvel specifically either, always getting free tickets to see the movies somehow. I have seen many movies in theaters. Most of the time when I've watched them has been in theaters. I don't think I've paid for a single ticket myself. I've always just had someone who's like, hey, I really want to go see the new whoever movie. And I have no one to go with. Will you come with me? I'll pay for your ticket. And I'm like, I guess, sure. And so it all started when I was 15, and I had a couple aunts and uncles who were really excited for the Avengers movie, the original Avengers movie. And at that point, I had only seen Thor. It was the only Marvel movie I'd seen at that point. My Uncle Tom was like, this is all you need. I was like, cool. I was awake for the first 30 minutes. I fell asleep for most of it, woke up for the last 10. He's like, you know what, you know everything you need to know, it's okay. And so we all went, it was a big family gathering. It was my parents, my aunts and uncles, siblings, stuff like that. We all went to go see this movie. And so with the fact that I'd only seen Thor, a lot of these characters are being introduced to me for the very first time. I'm meeting Captain America for the first time, I'm meeting the Hulk, I'm meeting Iron Man, I'm meeting Black Widow, I'm meeting all of these characters for the very first time. And one of the scenes that really stood out to me was actually an argument between Captain America, Steve Rogers, and Iron Man, Tony Stark. So they don't really get along very well throughout this movie, and I think in general don't get along very well. Cap is much more traditional. He is technically a much older man, just stayed young after being frozen, and so his values are a lot more old school. He's very self-sacrificing, you know, give up yourself for the greater good type thing, and Iron Man definitely is more like, I'm gonna save myself and the other people, but I'm definitely saving myself at the same time. So they get into an argument, and Cap says in this exchange, yeah, you're a big man in a suit of armor, take that off and what are you? And Tony Stark's response was, genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist. And I'll be honest, 15-year-old Linnea went, ugh. I was not impressed. I was kind of like, he's supposed to be one of the good guys? He's supposed to be a hero? Okay, sure. And so at that point, that began my dislike for Iron Man. I was not a big fan of Tony Stark. I did not like his character. I understood that, yes, at the end of the day, he technically helped save the day in his movies, which I'll admit I have not seen to this day. he does save the day. But I really did not like his character, at least from what I had seen at that point in the Avengers movie. He was supposed to be a good guy, but he, to me, came off as arrogant, self-serving, and mostly just loved the attention of being a superhero. So I wasn't very impressed. And so today, similar to Tony Stark, who at the time I might have put more in of an anti-hero category, we're going to look at the Bible's original anti-hero. And so we're going to be looking at the life of Samson. If you were here last week, John preached on his birth and what was being told about who he was going to be. And today we're going to dive into who he is. But before we buckle up, because we're going through chapters 14, 15, and 16 today, this morning, in Judges. I'm going to pray before we get going. Dear Lord, I just thank you for this morning. Lord, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the fact that we can be here to worship you and to learn from you. I pray that we have hearts that are ready to hear from you what you have to say to us. I am so grateful for you, God, and I am grateful for the way that you love us and care for us, even in our own arrogance and our own self-serving tendencies. I pray that we would be open to your gentle correction this morning and know that you are a loving, faithful God. So in your name I pray. Amen. Okay, so I'm not going to read Judges 14 through 16 because that would probably be the entire 35-minute slot in and of itself. But I'm just going to go through a summary of it. So if you were here last week, you find out Samson's born. Samson's birth is a big deal. Like, God himself comes down and says he's going to be super baby, basically. He's going to have super strength. Don't cut his hair. Mom's not allowed to drink before she has him, all these things. And he is going to be named Samson. So Samson is blessed with this incredible strength. He has almost this strength that is unexplainable. It makes it so that he can do things like tear a lion in half, kill 1,000 men with a donkey jaw, things like that. And he also ends up becoming a judge of Israel. So a judge is a leader, as we've been learning throughout this series, of the Israel people. And here's the thing, though. Samson doesn't necessarily have the greatest character. It all starts with he sees a woman, she's a Philistine, so she's not, you know, Jewish, she's not from Israel. And the big thing was marrying within your own religion, your own culture. That was a big deal back then. And when Samson sees this woman, he goes, I want to marry her, to his parents. And they're like, there are lots of nice ladies over there. And he goes, absolutely not, I want that one. So they go, and he insists on marrying a Philistine woman. And it was on his way to meet her that him and his family almost get attacked by a lion. And the Spirit of the Lord, this is something that happens often throughout Samson's story, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson. So in that moment, God comes upon Samson and gives him this divine strength to take care of whatever it is. So God is going to consistently throughout Samson's life, when Samson's life is in extreme danger, come in and save him. And so when this lion comes to try and attack him and his family, Samson has this divine strength to literally rip this lion apart. I don't think that's something anyone here can boast of doing. And ends up stopping the attack. They then continue on their way, because Samson's determined to marry this Philistine woman. And on, they go down, he's like, yep, I like her. And his, you know, her father agrees, and they're like, okay, cool, y'all get married. He ends up leaving to go back, and he goes home, and then as he's coming back to finally get married to her, he's, for whatever reason, deciding he wants to look around for this lion carcass again. And so he ends up seeing that a beehive has been established within the carcass. And he has this, I guess, brilliant idea of, what if I just scoop some of that honey out and I eat it? A lot of laws about cleanliness are being broken in this very moment. This is not something that they should be doing. He also ends up taking it and sharing it with his parents without telling them, like, hey, I got this out of a dead lion. And they go on their way. So, again, he also doesn't have a lot of respect for the law that they're supposed to be following. He does not care for it. He does whatever he wants. Samson goes by the beat of his own drum. And at this point, he's finally getting married. There's a 7-day feast to celebrate his marriage. And he ends up getting this posse of like 30 men. And Samson has a tendency to want to try and get things for himself. He's a very self-serving person. And he can be a bit tricksy about it as well. And so he looks at the men that he's hanging out with for these 7 days of feasting. And he goes, hey, so I have a riddle, and I'm going to give you 7 days to answer that riddle. If you answer the riddle, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. Everyone's getting a new outfit on Samson. But he says, if you can't figure it out by the end of the feasting, then you owe me the 30 garments and the 30 outfits. That would be great if it wasn't for the fact that this was honestly a bogus riddle. Anyone here who's seen Lord of the Rings, if you watch the Hobbit movie or if you read the book, so Bilbo, like this riddle is on the scale of Bilbo's bogus riddle in the Hobbit, where him and Gollum are in this a back and forth of riddles to decide whether Gollum's going to eat him. And he's like, well, whoever can stump the other one first, that's the one who gets out alive. And eventually Bilbo was floundering, trying to think of the next one. He goes, what's in my pocket? And Gollum's like, that's not a riddle. But Bilbo gets out of it. It's on that level of, this is bogus, this doesn't make sense. No one's going to know the answer to this. So Samson's riddle is, out of the one who eats came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. I'll give you a moment. What do you think he's referring to? Honey from the, exactly. Oh, I love this. We're in youth group all over again. So it's the honey from the beehive in a lion. This isn't a normal occurrence. You don't just walk down the street and see honey and a beehive established in a lion carcass. That's not a normal thing. So again, this is a bogus riddle. Like who the heck is gonna guess that? That's not what a riddle is supposed to be. It is supposed to be somewhat guessable. And so these 30 men who are all Philistines are understandably upset of like, what the heck, we're about to go broke because this guy gave us a bogus riddle. What in the world could that even possibly be? And in response, the Philistines go to Samson's new wife and start to threaten her. They're like, you need to tell us what the answer to this riddle is because it's bogus, or we're going to kill you and your family. And she's like, cool. So she goes to Samson over and over and over again and is begging him, please tell me the answer to your riddle. You haven't told me, and as your wife, I feel I should know. And Samson keeps saying, no, no, no. And then eventually, on the seventh day, he gives in, and he tells her, and her, trying to save herself and her family, runs to go tell the men, tells them the answer. And so Samson, who was really hoping to, you know, just get some extra money in, some extra stuff through tricking these people with this bogus riddle, ends up owing them some stuff instead. And he's very mature in his response to the Philistines when he finds out that they now know the answer, and he realizes very quickly, like, oh, my wife told them. How dare she? And he says, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you have not solved my riddle. Guys, don't talk about your wives that way. Just some advice. So he's not very respectful to other people. He is constantly trying to cheat people. He has no respect for his wife because after this, he's so upset with her that he just kind of gives her away to one of the random men in this posse of 30 men. He says, here, you can have my wife. I don't want her anymore. And then he dips. And so he gets out of there. And after he's done pouting, throwing his, you know, his little fit that he had to go and pay someone some money and he lost the bet, he decides, well, maybe I do like my wife. Maybe I do want her back. He decides to go back. So in Judges 15, it says, later on, at the time of the wheat harvest, Samson took a young goat and went to visit his wife. He said, I'm going to my wife's room, but her father would not let him go in. I was so sure you hated her, he said, that I gave her to your companion. Isn't her younger sister more attractive? Take her instead. Samson said to them, this time I have a right to get even with the Philistines. I will really harm them. So he went out and caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. Then he fastened a torch to every pair of tails, lit the torches, and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and standing grain together with the vineyards and olive groves. When the Philistines asked, who did this? They were told, Samson, the Timnite's son-in-law, because his wife was given to his companion. So the Philistines went up. So the Philistines went up and burned her and her father to death. Samson said to them, "Since you've acted like this, I swear that I won't stop until I get my revenge on you." He attacked them viciously, slaughtered many of them, and then went down and hid in a cave. So Samson ends up going back, wants his wife back, probably to save the reputation of his wife. Her father has then allowed her to get married to this man, so she isn't, you know, a woman who's just having an inappropriate relationship with a man, and to save her own reputation and his and his family and her honor. But Samson goes back, no, I want her back. I know I threw her away, but I want her back now. And is super angry about it, throws his fit, and he ends up deciding, well, I'm so mad about it that I'm going to make sure everyone in this town starves. I'm going to burn all their food. I'm going to get rid of all of it. And the Philistines at this point are fed up with Samson and decide to get back at him by killing his wife and her family. So Samson then runs away, isn't very good at taking responsibility for his actions, doesn't have a very cool temper. And at this point, the Philistines are ready to go to war to get after Samson. They are sick of this guy bothering them, trying to cheat them, all these different things. And so they go to Judah, the Israelites, and they're ready to, they got beef, we're ready to fight, get in the ring, ding, ding. And what ends up happening is the Israelites, 3,000 of the men, go to find Samson, and they're like, "What in the world are you doing? We are about to be attacked. This sucks. What is wrong with you?" And Samson says, "I don't want you to kill me. Tie me up. You can bring me to the Philistines, and I will be handed over to them." So they tie him up, bring him to the Philistines. And of course, as is customary in Samson's life, the Spirit of the Lord then comes upon Samson and saves him. And Samson breaks free of his bonds, and he ends up finding a donkey jaw, and he starts just whacking guys. And he ends up killing 1,000 men with a donkey jaw. And he says, after he killed the men, Samson would yell, "With a donkey's jawbone, I have made donkeys of them. With a donkey's jawbone, I have killed 1,000 men." God really does have a sense of humor. But after this moment, after Samson has ticked off the Philistines, has ended up creating a ton of tension between Israel and the Philistines, Samson becomes a judge. So he's now in charge. He is now the one in charge of Israel. And he ends up being in charge of Israel for about 20 years. The thing is, as you think at this point, Samson would hopefully learn his lesson and learn that God has blessed me with the strength, and he will come and he'll care for me, and he will make sure that I am safe, and I am now going to give all of my devotion to him because I've been given this great honor and responsibility of being a judge Israel. We think Samson would do that. Unfortunately, he does not. So Samson goes on to continue to be a very vengeful, lustful man who lived for himself. And the Philistines were so upset with him at this point that they just wanted to get a hold of him and kill him. So Samson at this point is known for sleeping around with a lot of women. And his newest fling that he's supposedly in love with is Delilah. You very quickly learn Delilah does not reciprocate those feelings very much, because it doesn't take much for the Philistines to pay her off and say, "We will pay you if you find out how Samson has this incredible power so that we can subdue him and arrest him and take him in." She says, "Okay, cool." So she goes and has 3 separate exchanges. "Samson, tell me, how do you have this super strength? How is this possible?" And he always, each time, gives her a bogus answer of like, "Tie me up with fresh bowstrings and I will be subdued and my power will be taken from me." And each time she will tie him up, whoever it is that Samson says to, and then yell in the middle of the night, "The Philistines are upon you!" And then he'll break free of his bonds, prepared to go fight. No one's there. This happens three times. Three times she tries to subdue him and make him powerless. Samson's not very smart either. You'd think he would catch on by this point. Like, I think this woman's trying to kill me. He does not. And so for the fourth time, she pleads to him and says, Samson, please, you have been lying to me. Tell me the truth. And he says, fine. You got to cut my hair. She's like, okay. So then she goes back to the Philistine. She's like, okay, I got it this time. He told me what it is. I have to cut his hair. And then you'll be able to take him in. So Samson once again falls asleep, and she cuts his hair. And she yells, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And he goes, okay, I'm ready to fight. And the Lord does not come to Samson this time. Samson was told one thing, you will keep your strength if you just don't cut your hair. And he gave away his secret so someone could cut his hair. The Philistines take him in, and they gouge his eyes out, and then put him in prison, and they use him to grind grain in a mill. That is Samson's life. Samson's final moments are in Judges 16. And in Judges 16, this is what it says. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to celebrate, saying, our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands. When the people saw him, they praised their God, saying, our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who laid waste our land and multiplied our slain. While they were in high spirits, they shouted, bring out Samson to entertain us. So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. When they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hand, put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple, so that I may lean against them. Now the temple was crowded with men and women. All the rulers of the Philistines were there, and on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. Then Samson prayed to the Lord, sovereign Lord, remember me. Please, God, strengthen me just once more, and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. Samson reaches out, hands up, toppling the two pillars, and with that, Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. He pushes the pillars, and they fall, and he kills many people. Those are his final moments. If you notice, his final moments were getting revenge for his two eyes. Lord, come and give me strength for me. It's about me. So I'll be honest. I was really excited when John said that he was preaching on Judges. It's probably my favorite Old Testament book of the Bible. And so when he was like, Linnea, would you like to preach? I was like, yes, yes. And then after some time, he's like, just give me some time to figure out who you're preaching on. I'm like, hey, cool. But I'm excited. I'm like, this is going to be good. He's like, Linnea, you're going to preach on Samson. And I'm like, no. I was like, really? It couldn't have been, like, maybe Deborah was too much to ask for. I could be satisfied with Gideon. What about the guy who stabs the fat king and says, I have a message from the Lord? Like, all these cool moments. Samson? But I think also stories like Samson are hard to read for us because they can be some of the most convicting. And so as we look at Samson's life, I want to propose three lessons that we can learn. Thank you for bearing with me through all that. But three lessons we can learn from Samson's life. The first one, which I think is a hard one for us to really grapple with, is God uses whoever he wants. And this can be really hard to accept. Samson wasn't a man of godly character. He slept around, he married formal women, he lied and tricked people for his own gain. He was vengeful, and often his actions were with the end goal of serving himself. Even his final moments in life were to serve himself. And I'm sure if you have ever been of voting age, you have thought to yourself, gosh, God, why are you allowing this person to be in office? Or, goodness, God, why are you allowing this person to be like my boss or whatever it is, someone in power that you are like, oh my gosh, why are they here? I don't like their character, I don't like who they are. You are not alone in that sentiment. The Israelites had the same feelings about Samson. They went and collected him to hand him over to the Philistines because like, oh my gosh, this guy is causing us more issues than saving us. I don't understand what they probably thought. I don't know what God is thinking. Why'd he give this dude superhuman strength? Why not that nice person over there who follows the law and actually cares about people beyond himself? Thing is, though, is God did end up using Samson to keep Israel safe from the Philistines. And whether it be because of, whether it be in politics, your boss, or even a pastor, whoever it is, we will not always understand why God puts someone in a position of power. But God uses whoever he wants to. And it's really easy to start pointing the finger and judging other people. And God, why is that person there? Why is that person there? Why is that person there? But we don't ever want to be the one to look at ourselves and say, God, how gracious of you to still use me. How kind of you to still use me, because I know I'm not perfect either. Maybe I've been the bad leader before. I made the wrong call. But God, you still use me. And so God uses whoever he wants. And it's no matter your flaws, your mistakes, your sin. God wants you to be part of his grand story, his plan for salvation and redemption. God wants you to be part of that today, church. He doesn't want you to be a Samson, but he wants you to be part of it. And he gives us all that invitation. But here's the thing. It's on you how your story is told. That's on you. How your story is told, how you are remembered, that is on you. And so the second point is we can't mistake the gifts of the Spirit with the fruit of the Spirit. We can't mistake the gifts of the Spirit with the fruit of the Spirit. We are all given gifts. God blesses us all with gifts, with talents, many different things. He blesses us in so many ways. But just because we are blessed and given much, it doesn't mean we've been a good steward of it. In Galatians 5, 22, 23, it says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Just because someone has gifts does not mean they are producing the fruits of the Spirit. It does not mean that they are using the talents and gifting that God has given them for God and his kingdom. Samson was blessed by God. This was known for a fact even before he was born. God came and spoke of how Samson was to be blessed, to be a judge, to have strength, to protect. And yet, when you consider the fruits of the Spirit, this is what the fruits of spirits are. It's the outward expressions of someone who actively seeks God's direction and will for their life. I don't know if that's how we would describe Samson. He was more lustful than loving. He was more angry than joyful. He was demanding instead of patient. He was arrogant over kind. He was vengeful, not good. He cast away his own wife because she made him angry. He was not very faithful. He was violent over gentle. And he was certainly more impulsive than he was self-controlled. Samson was the example of someone who was given much by God and used it for his own gain, glory, and pleasure. It is important that we don't get caught up in how talented someone is, but instead the character of an individual. Church, it is important that we don't get caught up in how talented we are, but instead care about our character. A couple Sundays back, John spoke about Ravi Zacharias. And I had known Ravi's name. He's pretty popular within the Christian Missionary Alliance. And I had known his name partially because I went to Nyack College, which was the CMA school at the time. And I had a professor who was personally mentored by Ravi Zacharias. And Ravi really changed his life a lot by being a mentor to him. And Ravi was well known, if you don't know who he was a minister and apologist, theologian, who was really well known and respected for all of the thought that he brought to the Christian world. And a lot of people had come to faith through his works. But unfortunately, when he passed away, it came out that he had been sexually abusing a lot of women. He had been abusing and hurting lots of people, and there was an investigation done by both his organization, along with the Alliance, our denomination. They did their own investigation as well, and came out there was a lot of truth, and lots of women were hurt. And here's the thing. Now when we think of Ravi, his legacy isn't of everything that he had done throughout his life and all the work that he did do for God. He instead known for his bad character that he hid. We decide how we are remembered. And then there are people who also well known within the CMA, someone that I loved learning about when I was at NIAC, A.B. Simpson. Some of you will know him, some of you know his story, some will not. A.B. Simpson was the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. He was by no means a perfect man. I do not want to put him on the pedestal of God. He was not a perfect man. He struggled a lot with his mental health. He was someone known to overwork himself in burnout and then have to take long periods of rest. So he did not have the best mental health, and he did not take care of himself as well as he should have. He did not always follow Sabbath. He also dealt a lot with a lot of issues in his personal life, him and his wife, butted heads quite a lot. He was known to make very sudden, risky moves that would put their family in potential financial danger and things like that. And she was like, "What are you doing?" And he was like, "It's for the Lord." And he wasn't always the best husband in that way. Thankfully, God had that family in his hands, but he was by no means a perfect man. I want to make that clear. But he was someone who we remember because he does have a legacy of someone who produced the fruits of the Spirit, who was gifted and then also allowed God to be the person who directed his life, was the one who he went to decide his next steps, and that he was in deep relationship with. A.B. Simpson, when he was a pastor in New York City, was a pastor of a really big church in New York City, in Manhattan. And he had a big heart for the lost. If anything, he had a major dream of one day being a missionary. And so what he would do when he was a pastor of this big church is he would go down to the docks in New York City, and he would eat lunch with the dock workers. And he would sit with them, he'd get to know them, he would preach the gospel to them, and then he would invite them to church. This church that he was a pastor of was a very big, rich church full of very upper-class people who were not happy that Irish immigrants, rugged Irish immigrants, were walking into their church. Simpson was given two options: either stop bringing these people into our church or leave. Simpson left. He left and he did whatever he could. He trusted God through the ups and downs of his ministry. And he did things like open up healing houses in New York City where people who were struggling to get care could go and get some basic first aid and then also be prayed for. And there were miraculous healings done in these healing houses. He did wild things. I'll never forget when I saw the picture of one of them. There was a horse-drawn carriage with a piano on it and a small choir and a preacher, and they would just kind of travel around and preach the gospel. Wild, crazy things for this time period. And the other thing is that Simpson then later on went and established the Missionary Training Institute. This would later become NIAC College, the college I went to. And the thing is he did that and founded a denomination and all those things. But what a lot of people don't know is that he gave up a dream to do all that. He wanted more than anything to go be a missionary in China, because he knew how many people were lost. He just desperately wanted to go and be a missionary. He thought that was his calling. God said, "I have something greater for you if you're willing to lay this down." And so he gave up a dream to then be able to train up tons of more missionaries who did tons of more work than he could have done on his own. And that's what we remember Simpson for. We remember his faults so that we can learn from them. But his name is one that when we speak of him, we speak of someone who we can look up to, someone we look up to just like how we look up to King David or the Apostle Paul, who were not perfect people, but did great things for the Lord, and we could see that they sought after the Lord. So my last point is God provides the gifts and talents. We decide the legacy that we leave behind. There are so many things in this world we cannot control. That's why recently I shared the Serenity Prayer. It's something I tell myself often because there's so much I cannot control in this world. We cannot control the people who are in power over us. And we can't even really control the gifts that God gives us. But we can decide how we use the blessings God has given us. Today, I want you to think, what ways has God blessed you? What gifts do you have? What are your talents? Where has God blessed you? What are those things? Are they in your head? Do you know what they are? If you don't know what they are, come speak to like me or John or one of the elders later. We'll help you. but if you know what they are, if you know what your gifts are, your talents are, now I want you to ask yourself, be really honest with yourself. Who are you using those gifts for? Are you living a life that reflects the fruits of the Spirit? Are you loving? Are you joyful? Are you patient? Are you kind and good and faithful and gentle and full of self-control? Earlier I spoke about Tony Stark. We're gonna go back to Marvel real quick. And I really, 15-year-old Linnea, was not impressed, did not like him, did not see him as a superhero, any of those things. But as I continued to get free movie tickets to go see Marvel movies, I got to see more of Iron Man, Tony Stark's character arc that goes throughout multiple movies. And eventually he meets Peter Parker, which is Spider-Man, starts to kind of mentor him and whatnot. They have kind of this father-son relationship a little bit going on. And you see Tony start to change a bit. He goes from being this guy who's like, yeah, cool, look at me, I'm a celebrity superhero, to, hey, Peter, calm down. Don't be like me, please. Goodness, please don't be like me. And really starts to mature a bit. And sorry if you haven't watched them. I don't want to tell you, they've been out for a while. So there's going to be lots of spoilers right now. And so as we get to Infinity War, he ends up watching people like Peter Parker die. And it really hits him of what's important in life. And so Infinity War ends, Thanos has won, tons of people are gone, like half of the world population is gone. And the next time we see Stark, which is in Endgame, he has taken a step back from the whole superhero thing to try and focus on what matters most to him. He's finally focusing on his wife and now his child. He has a daughter. And as we go throughout the movie, he finally gets pulled back into the whole superhero thing. As he is worried though, he's like, I have things I care about in this world, things I neglected for so long, people I neglected for so long. But he knows he needs to fight for them, fight for the people to have been lost. So at the end of Endgame, Stark's last moments are of sacrificing himself to save everyone who currently lives and to save everyone who died in Infinity War. Earlier, I talked about an argument between Captain America and Iron Man, and what I didn't share was the full argument. So Cap, once again, says, yeah, you're a big man in a suit of armor, take that off, what are you? Stark says, genius, billionaire, playboy, philanthropist. I'm so cool. I didn't say that part, but. And Cap says, I know guys with none of that that are worth 10 of you. I've seen the footage. You're the only one that you really fight for. The only one you really fight for is yourself. You're not the guy to make the sacrifice play, to lay down on the wire and let the other guy crawl over you. Stark says, I think I would just cut the wire. Cap says, always a way out. You know you may not be a threat, but you better stop pretending to be a hero. Cap also did not see Iron Man as a hero. And he's basically saying, you will save people up until it costs you something. You're always gonna have some way to get yourself out in the end. You will never make the full-on sacrifice needed, if need be. You will always put yourself first. In Endgame, Iron Man's last moments was proving that he was no longer the arrogant man he once was, that when it came down to it, he could make the sacrifice of himself if it meant saving others. His last moments were proving that he was a hero. He ends up dying in order to save everyone, to save his family. He ends up saving everyone who had died in the previous movie. They all come back. He reverses everything at the sacrifice of himself. Something that Cap said you would never do. Something that 15-year-old Linnea was like, yeah, he would never do that. But he did. So church, what will your legacy be? How will you be remembered? I want to end with some lines from a song that I heard a couple years ago. And it's a beautiful song that was also very convicting for me personally when I heard it. It's a song called No One Ever Cared For Me Like Jesus. If my heart could tell a story, if my life would sing a song, if I have a testimony, if I have anything at all, no one ever cared for me like Jesus. His faithful hand has held me all this way. And when I'm old and gray and all my days are numbered on the earth, let it be known in you alone my joy was found. Let my children tell their children, let this be their memory, that all my treasure was in heaven and you were everything to me. No one ever cared for me like Jesus. His faithful hand has held me all this way. And when I'm old and gray and all my days are numbered on the earth, let it be known in you alone my joy was found. What I leave with you today, church, is to ask yourself the question, what will your legacy be? Join with me in prayer. Jesus, I thank you for being a God who gives us the continuous invitation over and over and over again, saying, do you want to join me in this grand story of salvation and redemption? That you're a God who looks at the broken and lost and says, I want to save you. I have a plan for you. Are you willing to join me? Lord, wherever we are in our faith, whether we have stepped away, whether we are unsure if we ever want to trust you, if we ever want to believe in you, if we're really in this whole thing, whether we're someone who has just kind of put you on the back burner because we've been so focused on life, Lord, I pray that today we would sit with you honestly and ask you, God, where am I serving myself over you? Lord, how can I better serve you for a plan greater than myself, greater than my own pleasure, greater than my own desires, but Lord, for something that is life-saving, your life-saving news of grace, of mercy, of salvation. I thank you, Lord, today. It's your name I pray. Amen.